With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Welcome to Open Minds Radio with Alejandro Rojas. Open Minds Radio is your UFO news authority, presenting evidence and the latest news regarding the UFO phenomenon. Here's your host, Alejandro Rojas.
Hello, it is I, Alejandro Rojas, and this is Open Minds Radio, and we are happy to be speaking with you all today. One, because we love you guys, and two, because we love UFO news and stories, and we have, as usual, a lot of great stuff to share with you today. Our guests are an exciting part of this show today. That is Noe Torres and Ruben Uriarte, a couple researchers who we've had on the show before, but they have a brand new book out. For those of you who are Coast to Coast fans, you might have heard them. About a week ago, I think, they were on Coast to Coast. After I sent them an email to schedule them for this, Coast is reading my email. There's a conspiracy. But that's okay. We share. But anyway, these guys wrote a book that is very interesting about this gentleman in the 60s who was harassed by aliens. Kind of reminds me of the Kentucky story we talked about not too long ago. The little green aliens that Spielberg based E.T. off of, where this family was harassed. Where this wasn't a family, this was just one guy in California. Now he's much older, of course, but Ruben and Noe have interviewed him, and they shared with us a lot of clips. So it's almost like we have three guests, Noe, Ruben, and the witness, Mr. Shrum, who will play. So it's a very, very crazy, interesting story, but it seems pretty credible, and you'll hear why. And there were some popular ufologists of the time who did believe that this case was credible. So we'll talk to you about why. Unfortunately, Ruben is a little under the weather, so he won't be talking much, and he'll be trying to not cough on the microphone as best as he can. Poor guy. But luckily, Noe is very learned on the subject, and he will tell us all about it. So this is going to be an exciting show. It's a really interesting book. Of course, guess what else is going on that I've been telling you guys about very much the last couple of weeks? Because it's exciting, and it's going to be exciting. It's always exciting when we get the chance to meet you all. And if you come to the UFO Congress in late February, the 22nd to the 26th, that can and will happen. Go to the website, at least go to the website and look at it, you know, just for the heck of it, because it's cool. There's pretty pictures, and it's a cool website and stuff, ufocongress.com. Take a look, you know, if you haven't already registered and you're thinking about it, or you're thinking, you know, I don't know if I want to borrow money from mom again. Go to the page and check it out, and you're going to get so excited looking at the pictures, you're going to be phoning up mom and dad and going next door to Ralph and saying, Ralph, loan me a couple $100. You can sleep on the hotel floor. Let's go to Phoenix for the 2012 UFO Congress. So it's going to be a lot of fun, a lot of incredible speakers. Of course, we've got really – these are the favorites. When we put out the surveys and who people want to hear talk, they want to hear Whitley Strieber. They want to hear Colin Andrews. They want to hear Stephen Greer. Really, those are probably the three top requests we got for speakers. So we said, okay, you want those three people? We'll bring them all at once. How's that? We're just like, boom. So that's pretty sweet. You know, I don't know that any of those three have all spoken together at one conference. I think they hate each other to death, but that's okay because they're still willing to go. I'm just kidding. I don't think they hate each other. Sometimes ufologists do, but they're very friendly at the UFO Congress. And even if they don't like each other and they were to wrestle on stage, that would be exciting. And the possibility of that happening is always exciting at the UFO Congress. So we've got three big guys right there. We've also got General Ricardo Bermudez, a Chilean Air Force general, who is the director of their committee to study UFOs. We've got Ben Hansen from Factor Faked. We have the guy who runs MUFON, the biggest UFO UFO investigative group in the United States of America. Yvonne Smith, Chuck Zukowski, Lee Spiegel, my good buddy who, well, these are all my good buddies, but who writes for the Huffington Post, Robert Panotti, Travis Walton with John Goulet, Bruce McBee, Randall Nickerson, Rosemary Ellen Guiley, Antonio Junez, oh my gosh, Antonio Junez is speaking, David Sarita, Jaime Musan, who wasn't here last year, and a lot of people were asking, where's Jaime, I need Jaime, well, we got him, okay, chill out, he's going to be at this conference. Peter Robbins, Bryce Zabel, who we had on last week. In fact, we're going to have these guys on the show. We've had them all on the show mostly already, but we'll have some more coming up soon. So the Congress, of course, is a lot of fun, so be sure to check that out. It's a beautiful location, beautiful weather, and beautiful people. There's just a lot of them. So if you like that kind of thing, come to the Congress. So we're really excited about it, obviously, and it's coming up really quick here, so you better register and get in soon so you can get all the discounts and get in for cheap. So that's my UFO Congress spiel. Let's go ahead and talk about something else that we're always busy with, and that is UFOs in the news. There's, on a daily basis, all kinds of UFO news all over the world. This guy, Jason McClellan, is like all over the place, virtually traveling the globe to find all these UFO stories, and he comes here to share those stories with us every week. Jason McClellan, glad to have you again. Talk some news, baby.
I have to catch my breath. I just got off a plane.
A virtual plane.
This trekking around the globe getting UFO news is exhausting.
Yeah.
Well, greetings, everyone. This is your Open Minds News Brief for Monday, January 9th, 2012. And Alejandro, bear with me. It might sound cheesy, but before I get into the news, I don't say it enough, but I would like to thank all of our wonderful listeners for tuning in week after week to this show. It does mean a lot. We appreciate it. And we are happy to do the show every single week for you. Thank you for indulging me.
Yeah, these guys are awesome.
All right. I'm going to start off with a story about Stephen Hawking. And you know when Stephen Hawking is in my news, it's because he's being a big downer again.
That guy.
I know.
Lighten up. He needs to lighten up.
Famed theoretical physicist Stephen Hawking celebrated his 70th birthday on Sunday. And to mark his birthday, he recently answered questions from listeners of BBC Radio Channel 4's Today's Show. According to the BBC, quote, topics range from the origins of the universe to the prospects for extraterrestrial life and the impact on Einstein's theory of relativity should neutrinos be confirmed to travel faster than light, end quote. The question that elicited the response about extraterrestrials was submitted by a Twitter user, and the question asked, quote, what do you think the impact will be on humankind if Kepler-22b does indeed support life, end quote. And Hawking responded, the discovery of intelligent life elsewhere in the universe would be the biggest scientific discovery ever, but it would be very risky to attempt to communicate with an alien civilization. If aliens decided to visit us, then the outcome might be similar to when Europeans arrived in the Americas. That did not turn out well for the Native Americans. Hawking made similar comments in a 2010 Discovery Channel special titled Into the Universe with Stephen Hawking. In the special, he cautioned against attempting contact with extraterrestrials, suggesting that they would likely be hostile. And this guy, again, is back to making his assumptions and painting all extraterrestrials as being these horrible things that are going to come and kill us and take our resources.
Yeah, it's kind of a funny message. It's a lot of fun, and it's great to look for aliens, but if we find them, we're screwed.
Right.
They're going to kill us, and we're dead, but it's a lot of fun to look for them. His daughter's even sending up messages. It's a lot of fun to send messages, but if they read the messages and they come, they're going to come kill us, and
I
we're
do
dead.
Always like to point that out. That does give me a chuckle. You know, despite his warnings, he still participated in his daughter's writing contest. It was called Dear Aliens, where she asked students to submit essays answering these questions, and the winning entry was beamed into space.
Mm-hmm.
They sent the message, so that in effect they were contacting extraterrestrials, and he was there at the ceremony giving this person their award and sending the message into space, even though he said not to.
Yeah.
But he also talked about, when he was on Today, he commented on space colonization, stating his opinion that humans need to colonize Mars and other bodies in the solar system to prevent extinction. Just last Thursday, former Apollo astronaut Buzz Aldrin wrote about the same topic on Huffington Post. He stated, quote, "To make a real difference from an exploration, science, national security, and international leadership perspective, our nation needs to commit to seeking a permanent presence on Mars." So here is Stephen Hawking saying we shouldn't contact extraterrestrials because they're probably hostile. Yet he thinks we need to go and put ourselves on Mars. So my comment is he better hope that they don't have theoretical physicists on Mars spouting the same downer material he is.
Yeah, they're
saying, watch out, aliens, if they come here, they're all going to be terrible and kill us. They're probably right. We probably would be terrible because we like to do that kind of thing. But
yeah, they would be right if they did.
But anyway, lots of talk about space colonization recently, so that's interesting. But in other news, NASA wants to use energy-producing bacteria to power small devices in space. According to the Huffington Post, experimentation with energy-producing bacteria is something that scientists have been doing for nearly a century. But, quote, applications of microbial fuel cell, MFC, technology are just beginning to blossom, end quote. MFC technology could be the perfect solution to power planetary robots because, as the Huffington Post states, quote, the bacteria in MFCs produce electrons automatically and reproduce over time. These devices are extremely reliable. They're also hardy, not needing any oxygen to live and able to survive in the low temperatures of deep space. On top of that, they're more efficient than standard lithium-ion batteries because bacteria can be packed together much more tightly, end quote. The U.S. Naval Research Laboratory, the NRL, reports that NASA hopes to use MFCs to power small space robotics, including micro-rovers that could potentially explore remote regions of outer space. And Alejandro, you may or may not have heard this, but there are some people who say that NASA, the government, et cetera, have actually taken alien technology and tried to reverse engineer it.
Yeah,
that might be something you've heard of. And perhaps this bacteria technology is something that they've taken from elsewhere.
Mm-hmm.
And you know where I've seen this before, and it makes me think exactly of this technology?
Hmm.
Batteries not included.
Oh, that's right.
Thinking of micro rovers, these tiny little robots. Because for this to work, for it to power, right now with the technology as it is, they have to be extremely small.
Well, and you know, think if there were these ultra micro tiny things, it'd be good for people in the future to send them back to the present because we wouldn't even see them.
Right.
And same with aliens. We wouldn't even know they were there. Well, and their crew crawling around looking at us.
There was an article today, and I didn't actually read it. I didn't actually make it to it, but I just saw the headline, and I think it was also on the Huffington Post talking about how scientists are working on these micro spy robot bugs, these little bugs that are small that have microchips in them to be used as spy equipment. Mini, 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 mini drones. Everyone wants to spy. I've got some UFO news, Alejandro. Two UFOs flying over the Western Australian town of Coolungup were captured by a night vision camera on December 29th. Hey, that was my birthday. According to the Daily Telegraph, the video shows, quote, a bright light crossing the moon and then mysteriously breaking into two pieces, heading in different directions. Several witnesses in other parts of Australia reported seeing similar UFOs on previous days. The witness uploaded the video to YouTube with the following description. Filmed in Coolungup, one orb and another appears next to it. Filmed in the southeast using a Yukon Spirit night vision attached to a JVC Eviro binocular was kind of out of focus a bit. To focus the whole thing, I needed to twist the front barrel of the scope and the back eyepiece and then adjust the camera manual focus with telemacro. While objects like the two that appear in this video are commonly captured with night vision cameras, some are suggesting that this particular video is fake because the second object appears out of nowhere.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we've looked at a lot of night vision video. There are plenty of strange things to be seen with night vision video. But, you know, things that are moving through the sky, whether they're satellites or something different, and a lot of times they're something different, you'll see them moving in a linear pattern, you know, just a straight line. And sometimes they'll turn, or, you know, even 90-degree turns, crazy fast, sharp movements. But in this video, I don't know if you saw this video, but it looks like most of these night vision videos where you have an object moving through the sky, and then next to it, this other object appears and goes, just kind of fades in. It doesn't split from the object. It just appears next to it and then goes the other direction.
You know what? I didn't look at this one, and I should have. I wanted to. It was on my to-do list, but I didn't do it.
Take a look at it. I'm curious to hear what you have to say about it. To me, you know, I've never seen any of the night vision videos do this, and you know, that doesn't mean anything. It doesn't mean that it's not authentic. It's not something that actually happened, but it's very strange. And, you know, even the description that was provided, I didn't see in the video. I didn't see it crossing the moon. I didn't see it splitting into two pieces. I saw this second thing kind of appear next to it and shoot off in another direction.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I read what you wrote about it, and I didn't go watch it.
There's always time for that, my friend.
Yep, I'll do that.
Because as I like to say at the end of the news, you can always read these stories on openminds.tv.
Good point.
Excellent.
Good point.
Here is news about favorite thing we like to talk about, SETI. Just kidding, it's not our favorite to talk about, but SETI seems to always be in the news, so I'm talking about SETI today. SETI, the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence, detected an unknown radio signal known as the WOW signal on August 15, 1977, with Ohio State University's Big Ear radio telescope that was so unexpected and impressive that it was named after the response its detection elicited. Wow! And after more than 34 years of silence, SETI recently detected new unknown radio signals. But instead of a WOW response this time, the new signals appear to have elicited more of a meh response. SETI scientists recently began using data obtained from NASA's Kepler Space Telescope, which allows their search for radio signals to be more focused. Ian O'Neill from Discovery News recently explained that first candidate signals resulting from this new approach were detected. These signals were announced by the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence at UC Berkeley on Thursday, January 5th. Their announcement stated, quote, "We started searching our Kepler-SETI observations, and our analyses have generated some of our first candidate signals." But as O'Neill explains, quote, "Sadly, the first candidate signals aren't lucky detections of alien radio transmissions," end quote. The Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence at UC Berkeley announced that the newly detected signals are, quote, "undoubtedly examples of terrestrial radio frequency interference," end quote. And to make this point absolutely clear, they updated their website the following day with the following message. "It became clear that we had not stated as definitely as absolutely as possible that these signals are interference. We have updated the post to make this clear. Sorry for any confusion." So even though they stated that these newly detected signals, quote, "look similar to what we think might be produced from an extraterrestrial technology," end quote, the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence at UC Berkeley is strongly pushing an assumption as fact. The International Business Times explains more SETI assumptions, stating, quote, "when a single signal, a Kepler object of interest, comes from multiple positions in the sky, researchers conclude that it's most likely due to interference." SETI scientists will continue analyzing data from the nearly 50 terabytes of data collected in early 2011, and results will reportedly be posted in the coming weeks. Perhaps a signal from ET is waiting in the data to be discovered, but I'm going to go out on a limb here, and I'm going to make my own assumption that more assumptions are going to be made.
Well, I don't know, but I kind of took it that these were their first kind of first pieces of information to play with. So they were looking for terrestrial stuff, anything that kind of fit, so that they were testing out their new stuff, their new way of doing this. But
so they're looking at the initial data they have.
Yeah.
And this is the first thing that they came across. And they couldn't identify it 100%. They just assumed that was interference.
Mm-hmm.
And
but from what I read, they were looking for interference. They were looking for anything that fit that just so they could see if it worked and play with it and see how it looked and stuff like that.
Right. But it's kind of silly to me to say this is what we were looking for because it's interference, yet this is what an ET signal will probably look like, so it's what we're looking for anyway. I mean, two of the signals they detected were not terrestrial. They could tell that it was either moving towards or going away from Earth.
Mm-hmm.
So it's interesting, but I think a lot of assumptions are made, as has been the case with SETI a lot.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know. It could be. I think it was just, misinterpretation, and they weren't careful in their wording, because assumptions on other sides can be made too.
Oh, yes.
That's what they're worried about, people running crazy with assumptions that, SETI says we got aliens, which people were.
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of a double-edged sword. But
yeah, it certainly is.
I, like you, hope they aren't being too skeptical and, disregarding actual anomalous data.
Right, and as the International Business Times pointed out, I think it's kind
of... But this is the International Business Times, so it's not scientists.
This is this is the International Business Times quoting SETI.
Okay.
But, saying that when a signal from a Kepler object of interest comes from multiple positions in the sky, researchers conclude that it's most likely due to interference.
They're thinking a satellite.
It's certainly possible.
That's what they said.
Right, but this comes from multiple positions in the sky. I mean, you think if extraterrestrials are out there, a certain race of extraterrestrials or something with many ships or different cities, different satellites of their own, their signals would come from multiple positions in the sky, not just one.
Mm-hmm.
So just dismissing those altogether, it's just like dismissing planets that are not Earth-like.
Yeah, but they're not dismissing them. They're just saying that's what they're looking for. That's their whole point, is that this is the type of thing we would look for. Most likely, and all of that kind of thing that we receive now turns out to be like our satellites and man-made things, but it's the sort of thing we look for that we know it's not just space static.
I will give them this. It's actually very smart of them, their new approach, to be using this Kepler information. I mean, Kepler is amazing. I love Kepler. And it's actually given us our best look into the rest of the universe.
Yeah.
And it gives them more to go on now than just kind of pointing satellites and guessing.
Kepler and the universe also. It's sweet.
like Kepler.
The universe rocks.
Yes. Well, Alejandro, I will wrap it up. That is it for the news for today. As I mentioned earlier, remember, you can check out all of these stories and so many more at openminds.tv, your source for UFO-related news. I'm Jason McClellan, your Open Minds news correspondent, and you have just been briefed. Back to you, my friend Alejandro.
All right. Thank you, Jason. Wonderful news, as usual. Some of the other stories that you're going to find out there are just recently... Antonio last week wrote a story on this politician, and he gave some more details about this European parliamentarian who also has written some UFO books, who may or may not make it into the position onto the European Parliament. And the reason being that everything looked fine because it was like his buddy who he was supposed to succeed, and his buddy's going to retire and everything, but then people started questioning because of the UFO thing, which is kind of silly. Why, not give him his position because he's written books on UFOs? So they've kind of postponed the whole thing for now to look further into it. And a lot of places have given, him a bad rap, calling him the MEP, which is the member of the European Parliament. That's what the MEP stands for. But they're calling him the MEP for Roswell and Bigfoot and goofy, silly kind of mean stuff that they're making fun of this guy. He seems like a really nice guy, and they have a picture of him shaking hands with David Cameron, the prime minister. So everything will probably go through pretty all right, but it's just interesting that they're having such a big debate and people are being so cruel to this guy just because he's written some books about UFOs. So you can check that out on openminds.tv. So check that out. But without further ado, we've got some great guests on today, so let's go ahead and listen to them. We've got Noe Torres and Ruben Uriarte. All right, we have a double doozy. Actually, we almost have, it's almost like three people on the show, because we have authors Ruben Uriarte and Noe Torres of Roswell Books, and then we've got some clips from their witness, Mr. Shroom, who had this incredible encounter, which is the topic of their latest book, Aliens in the Forest, the Cisco Grove UFO Encounter. So welcome, Noe and Ruben, back to the show.
Yes, thank you very much for having us today, Alejandro. We're so pleased to be on to talk about this remarkable case. And I'm also very happy that my colleague and dear friend Ruben is with us.
Thank you, Noe. Just fighting, I'm a little bit under the weather, so I apologize. But we've got a plan A there, and we have lots of audio clips and narration to share. So I hope the audience will find this case very interesting.
I'm sure they will. So, yeah, too bad you're under the weather. But luckily, we're all in the southern part of the country, so we're all enjoying better weather than most of our listeners probably. It's like 80 degrees here today. It's so nice. I've got the windows open. There's a nice breeze. Noe, you're in Texas, right?
Yes, I'm in South Texas along the border, and we're having really good weather also. We're in about the 60s, and we've got the windows open, nice, fresh, cool air. It's sunny, and we're just enjoying the weather here.
Oh, I wish I was there with you guys right now, because our weather, I live here in the San Francisco Bay Area. It's a little overcast, gray, and cold.
You're a little too far north, I guess, huh?
Yes.
Well, just take it easy up there. So let's get into your latest book. Of course, we've had you guys on before to talk about some of your other projects you've worked on. But real quick, I guess, Noe, before we get into your latest book, I haven't talked to you since you've done this one kind of based off of Cowboys and Aliens, the movie called The Real Cowboys and Aliens, where you did a book with John LeMay on UFO incidents, like in the real Old West.
Yes, actually, that book has been very, very successful for us. John LeMay, who's a historian in Roswell, New Mexico, and works for the Historical Society there, he contacted me shortly after the announcement from Spielberg's group that the movie Cowboys and Aliens was going to be made. He contacted me and said, you know, people are going to be focused on this topic, and a lot of folks don't realize that there were actual encounters between people in the Old West in 1800s U.S. and aliens or UFOs. So he and I started working on this project early on before the Spielberg movie, you know, was completed and released. And we worked for about a year on the book, and we compiled we looked at hundreds of cases from the 1800s. Where various ranchers and townspeople from the Old West, cowboys in several cases, actually encountered extraterrestrials. And it was a fascinating book to research and put together. John did a fantastic job. We had great contributions from John's friend, Neil Reby, who is really a world-famous illustrator and did the illustrations for the book. And as I say, we've just been so knocked out by all the tremendous response to our book, The Real Cowboys and Aliens. We speak a lot at schools and at gatherings of educators. It's been very, very popular among the middle school to high school age group, and we kind of targeted it at that level. And recently it was added to one of the main lists that's used for ordering books in the school districts, which has given our sales a big boost.
Cool.
And it's also under consideration for being included in the Accelerated Reader program.
Awesome.
Which is another program that's used in the school districts a lot. So, yeah, thank you for asking about that. It was a very good book for us.
Yeah, that's really cool. It sounds exciting. Is there... before we move on, just real quick, one kind of really cool story, maybe from a famous cowboy or a story which in particular people like?
probably the one that we get the most comments about. And in the book, we have a chapter for each specific case. We picked about 14 cases that really seemed above all the others in terms of credibility, documentation, and we're fairly confident that these incidents happened. Now, as to what the actual explanation was, you know, nobody knows for sure, but these are documented cases. And the one that we get a lot of comments about is the 1897 crash of an unidentified flying object in the Fort Worth, Texas area in a small town called Aurora. And many of your listeners are probably familiar with it, but we gathered together as much data as we could, and we did a chapter on this strange object that struck a windmill, fell in the middle of town in a big pile of wreckage. The people came out to look. They found a body amidst the wreckage. The newspaper accounts of the day say that it was not a human. It was humanoid, but was not a human. They called it a man from Mars or a man from the moon. Of course, this is the 1800s, and people, you know, don't have the scientific advances that we have today. And unfortunately, that occupant of that crashed UFO was dead at the time that they found him. And so wanting to give it a proper Christian burial, the townspeople gathered up the body, you know, prepared it and put it there in the town cemetery, where this very day people can travel from all over the world, and they do, to Aurora, Texas, a tiny little town, population of under 100 people in the Fort Worth area, and they can see a State of Texas historical marker plaque that's been placed there in front of the town, the old town cemetery, that mentions the reported crash of a spaceship and the burial of its only occupant in the town cemetery in 1897. It's a fascinating case, and people just love it when we speak to groups. They love hearing about that particular case.
Okay, cool. Yeah, that's a really interesting case. So, and just so the listeners know, they can go to roswellbooks.com to get that book or any of the books we're talking about, including your latest, Aliens in the Forest. So how did you all come across this story?
I'm going to ask Ruben to speak on this one, because he's the one that made the initial contact with the eyewitness in this case. And all of this came about through some great materials that he inherited when he became the director for the Mutual UFO Network in Northern California. Then he eventually acquired the files, all the wonderful documents, the reports, the photographs, the letters that were mailed back and forth, audio tapes. So he basically had this wealth of information about this case. So Ruben, can you fill in some more on how that initial contact happened?
Sure. There was an investigator that was involved in this case, Alejandro, back in 1964 is when the event happened. And I believe it was in 65 that Mr. Paul Cerny, who was with NICAP at the time, got involved in doing the investigation. And we'll be going into more of the story. But as Noe had mentioned, I was very fortunate to had come across all these files and that as I was the assistant state director for Northern California, and when Mr. Paul Cerny, who's no longer with us, he passed away in November of 2000, I gradually started acquiring some of his great cases, and then there was one in particular that just struck me about the bow and arrow cases, as it was referred. And with that, I said to myself, I would love to meet this man someday. And through another colleague of mine, I was able to meet with him in person, him and his family. They invited me to their home. I was there for about 2 days and was very, very fortunate to do an in-depth interview with them. Their son happened to record everything on video, which has turned invaluable to us. And their goal, Alejandro, was to – they wanted to see this story put into a book, and the real story. There's been variations of it told over the years in different articles and that, but never the real, true, complete story. And so I was very fortunate, of course, to have connected with Noe, and we then made this into a book.
Cool, yeah, and it sounds like, I mean, from these clips, you got enough to it. I mean, I think a lot of people think, wow, a whole book on one case. Of course, it's happened before, but a lot happened in this encounter.
Well, it is actually one of the most incredible and well-documented UFO cases of the 1960s. Until Ruben brought it to my attention, I, like many other people, had never really heard about this case. But it turns out that this is one of three cases that was very highly thought of by Dr. J. Allen Hynek and Dr. James Harder, who were two of the leading UFO investigators of the 60s and 70s. They were looking at three cases that had a preponderance of evidence and were they considered to be highly credible. That was the Betty and Barney Hill abduction of 1961, which most of your listeners, I'm sure, are familiar with. The Pascagoula, Mississippi UFO incident of 1973. And there was also the Travis Walton abduction in 1975. Now, all three of those cases have a lot of tie-ins and similarities to the Don Shrum Cisco Grove encounter that we're going to talk about on this show, but especially the Barney and Betty Hill and the Pascagoula, Mississippi incident, as well as this Cisco Grove encounter. These were the big three that Dr. Hynek and Dr. Harder looked at very closely and held in very high esteem. Now, the main reason that a lot of folks hadn't heard about this case and haven't is because the principal eyewitness, Don Shrum, was at the time working for a missile defense contracting firm in Sacramento, California, called the Aerojet Corporation. Now, they were the main manufacturers of missiles, including the Polaris and the Titan missile. And so when he had this UFO encounter while hunting with some of his buddies on a weekend, he didn't want to come out in public because of the sensitive nature of his employer's, the situation with his job, being of a sensitive nature and involved with making missiles for the government. So therefore, his identity was never released until now. It's only been in the past couple of years in the preparation and writing of this book that he's finally agreed to come out and tell his story with all the names of the people that were there with him on that day, his hunting companions and himself. And for the first time, we have the whole story to this case, which, as I started off by saying, it's one of the most significant UFO cases of the 1960s.
Yeah, well, the people you mentioned are very conservative researchers, so it says a lot if they felt that this was a credible case. What are some of the things, what makes this case so credible or this witness?
Go ahead, Ruben, because you've spent all this time with the Shrums, and you can speak to their high level of sincerity and credibility.
Well, there are a couple of things that we found this case to be really quite unique is the fact that, unlike other abduction cases, this was an apparent attempt to capture him by these species of beings. And he fought them off for about 12 hours and went through a great ordeal. And what we found most unusual is the fact that how he kept himself from being taken, and at the same time, he used his wits. He was a very resourceful man. The other thing I'd like to add is the fact that we had so much interesting documentation from NICAP, from the Paul's personal files, as well as the Shrums. They kept and compiled so many of documents. We had the great fortune of acquiring those so we could put together this book. The other thing is that the fact that this is a historical case, but as you know, Noe and I have been looking in various historical cases because we feel that there's so much real truth, real disclosure is in our past. So this is one of the reasons why we wanted to focus on this and tell this man is still alive, him and his family, and the fact to educate the public on this really fascinating case.
Cool. It's exciting. So let's get into the story. So how did it all start for this gentleman? It's unique you know, how it all began and what he was up to when it all started.
Yes. Mr. Don Shrum, back in September of 1964, as I mentioned, was working for the Aerojet Corporation, which was the nation's leading missile defense contractor for the U.S. government. And he and two other gentlemen from his workplace decided that they were going to go out hunting, deer hunting, and it wasn't rifle season yet for hunters in that area of California. They were going to go bow hunting with bow and arrow. So he and two buddies went out to the Tahoe National Forest, which is located east of Sacramento, near the California-Nevada state, you know, boundary. And so they went out to an area called that's known as Cisco Grove, California, and it's right there in the Tahoe National Forest. So they went early in the day on a Friday. They had a three-day weekend. They went early in the day, and they spent most of the day looking, you know, hunting. And it was getting toward evening, and the three became separated from each other. They took three different routes through the wilderness. And this was a very rugged and isolated part of the area, the wilderness area. And it's not a place that's frequented by campers or hikers. They were pretty far out there. So the three became separated. Mr. Shrum went up along a ridge, and one of the other hunters was on the opposite side of the ridge. You know, there was a big divide or ravine between them. And then the third hunter was down below at the bottom of the canyon. So Mr. Shrum thought that when he was going to get to the end of this ridge that he was walking alongside of, that there'd be a way that he could cross over and rejoin his companion on the other side. But it turned out there wasn't. So he had to backtrack. And heading back to camp, which was a couple of miles away from his position there, when he realized he had to backtrack, he realized that it was getting dark. It was already nearly dark. And prior to going out hunting, he had heard that there was a lot of bear activity that had been reported. Hunters had run into bear there in that area. So he was concerned about that. Also, he was not really familiar with this specific place. They had gone hunting out other places before, but he was a little bit unfamiliar with the territory, the terrain. So the fact that it would soon be dark, there were predators, including possibly bear in the area, prompted him to seek a place of shelter for the night rather than try to stumble through the rocky ravine-filled area in the dark and try to find his way back to camp. So this is a strategy that hunters sometimes adopt when they are separated from their hunting companions in the dark in an isolated area. They look for a place of shelter to hole up for the night. And he did that. And what he decided to do was he decided to go up into a tree. It was actually a pine tree. And he was going to rest and spend the night up there in the pine tree. He had a military-style belt that he could latch onto one of the larger branches up there. And he could safely spend the night safe from predators. And so that's what he did. Well, he was up there in that perch, and it was getting dark, when all of a sudden he noticed a very strange light headed his way. And that was the first appearance of a very large UFO that we call the mothership, which appeared first. And that's audio clip number 150, Alejandro, if you could press play on that one, and we'll listen to him describing the appearance of this ship.
Okay, great. I'll play that right now. Here it comes.
And then I saw a light. It looked like a lantern going up and down a trail. But then it came over the top of a tree, and I got kind of excited then because I thought it was a helicopter from the Forest Service. And I stood between two of the fires that I built on the rocks and waved my arms and yelled and screamed and finally that light started coming towards me. So I was really relieved then because I thought it was a helicopter still until it got within, oh, maybe 60 feet or yards. I'm not sure the distance at night. But it just hovered there with no sound. So then I panicked because I knew it was no helicopter. I thought it was something from outer space. But it looked like all I could see is a little, about an 8-inch glow. So I thought it was just a little tiny, you know, flying saucer. And then I kind of panicked and I threw my bow up in the tree again and hand walked out that limb and got up in the tree. And I had all camouflage clothing on, so I figured, well, they won't see me here, you know. But then this light went a half circle around me over the canyon. Then I could see the shadow of the whole spacecraft. And that was just a light that was on the nose of it.
Wow, that's interesting. I mean, he unfortunately called attention to himself because he thought it was a helicopter, and these guys came to check him out, and unfortunately, it wasn't who he thought it was.
That's right. In fact, he mentioned having set two fires at the base of the tree. There were some flat rocks. It's a very rocky area. And he actually gathered together some brush. He had a lot of boxes of matches with him, which come into play later on in the episode. But anyway, he set two separate fires, one on top of each of the rocks there, two flat rocks that were there. And so he did everything in his power to attract the attention, thinking that this was a helicopter that was sent from the Forest Service, that he thought that his friends had realized that he had gotten separated from them and had contacted the Rangers and that they had sent out a helicopter. But then he saw this immense object, which he later described as being approximately 150 feet from stern to bow. If you can imagine that immense size of this object, it was like a 14-story building turned on its side. It was cigar-shaped, had a very dark hull, and had this strange light at the front end of it, which he described as a headlight. And a most impressive size for a UFO, if you can imagine.
Yeah, that's humongous. That had to be quite a sight.
So the next thing that happens is he's watching this and he notices that, you know, the hull looks kind of dark at first. And in fact, the only thing he sees is this light at the front end of it. But then all of a sudden, these three lighted rectangular panels appear in the middle of the hull, evenly spaced, three large windows or portals. And so suddenly, you know, the side of this large mothership takes on this extra characteristic of having these three panels. And out of the centermost panel, another object, a smaller flying object, zooms out and drops down to the canyon below, as we're about to hear in the next clip that we're going to listen to, the appearance of this smaller ship, which we call the scout ship. The eyewitness Don Shrum describes how it appeared and what happened afterward.
Okay, so this is 200?
Yes.
All right, here we go.
And then I saw three panels of light, like windows or whatever. And I saw a flash come from the bottom of the center one, and just saw a dark object go down in the canyon, and then I lost track of it. And then the next thing I saw was a little blinking light up on the top of originally where the first one came from.
This object that you first saw that left the center panel, what did it look like, Don?
Well, at that time, all I saw was a flash and saw a dark object go down.
The dark object, what kind of, what shape was it?
Well, I couldn't really say. It went so fast. But then I saw when it landed up on the ridge that it, I could see like a half, I could only see part of the top, but it had a little light on it and looked like the top of a flying saucer.
Really?
That I'd seen in pictures.
Like a dome? Or
yes. Yeah, like a dome.
Okay.
And then I kept my eyes on that.
So at this point, I'm wondering, what was his state of mind? I mean, was it fearful at this point, or was it just fascination?
He had in his mind the thought that he could somehow hide. He had climbed back into the tree, and he was dressed all in camouflage from head to toe. And he was, you know, he tried to lose himself among the branches, the upper branches of the tree. He was hoping that although he had called their attention, you know, earlier, that perhaps they would not see him there. He was greatly concerned, though, because the appearance of the smaller ship, it came closer to his position, and he was starting to become somewhat concerned by the turn of events. But the point at which he became very gravely concerned was with what happened next, which was shortly after the smaller ship came out of the middle panel from the mothership and then zoomed close to a position where Mr. Shrum was, where the tree was, then he suddenly heard some noises in the brush that seemed to be growing louder and coming toward him. And in this next clip that we're going to hear, which is clip number 250, he gets his first look at the ETs that have come out of the smaller scout ship that landed nearby. So if you could roll that clip, Alejandro, then we'll listen to this incredible description.
And I heard some thrashing through the brush, and probably 5-10 minutes, these two humanoids come out of the brush, and they kind of broke some of the brush off and was looking at it. And then they came straight underneath the tree and looked up at me. And I knew right then I was fingered.
They found you.
Yeah, they found me.
Can you describe them for us? Tell us briefly what they
were. Yeah, they were, looked like 4 or 5 feet. Of course, I'm looking down at them, so they'd be shorter than they probably are. And they had a silvery, like a one-piece suit on. And it seemed like it had the joints, puffy joints, you know, on the shoulders and the elbows and the legs. I didn't see that clear.
The humanoids, were you able to see their faces?
No, it was just a kind of a dark shadow. I could see the two like eyes that were looked like welding goggles to me. They were the same as welding goggles. And then the rest of the face was kind of a blur. I couldn't see looking down at them.
you're able to see then was it large or small? They're
about 2 inches in diameter. It reminded me, just like I said, like a welding goggles.
Very strange.
So we've got in our book, Alejandro, we've got a number of sketches. We have some sketches that were done by Mr. Shrum shortly after his encounter. And then we've got some enhancements to that. We've had, there's been some professionally done sketches, including some sketches done just this year by artist Neil Reby, very excellent, based on Mr. Shrum's description of these strange beings. The thing that caught his attention most of all was these dark circular eyes. In fact, for years after this event, Mr. Shrum would wake up with screaming nightmares.
Wow.
And his wife reported him waking up in the middle of the night and screaming, saying, those eyes, referring to those dark, unearthly eyes of these humanoids that seem to probe into his mind and seem to be trying to gain, later on in the encounter, they seem to be probing into his mind, trying to gain the upper hand on him as the story goes on.
And so did you want to hear the next clip?
Well, let me set the stage for the next clip by saying that his troubles were actually only beginning with the arrival of the humanoids, because there was a distinctly different type of creature that appeared next, which ended up being much more threatening and menacing to him. This second creature was a bulkier or larger looking creature that Mr. Shrum described as a robot, although it could have been a humanoid dressed in a bulkier type of suit. He's not completely certain, but the overall impression of it was that it was robot-like, which incidentally, in a lot of UFO cases, the ETs that are seen by witnesses, sometimes they're given characteristics of robots or mechanical beings. So it's not an unusual thing in UFO cases. But anyway, in this next clip, Mr. Shrum describes this second type of being that suddenly appears on the scene, and this is when things get really, really dicey for him.
And then I saw two flashing red-orange light eyes just picking its way down the ridge, just between the rocks and around them and everything, and come down and was on this big boulder, this big flat rock, and then he kind of looked up at me, and he moved his hand through the fire cinders and kind of scattered them.
And the eyes of this other creature, like the robot, what did that look like to you?
It had kind of like fire. It's kind of a orangish, reddish orange, or yellowish orange, and it kind of flickered like fire. And they're about the same diameter as about 2 inches in diameter as the humanoids.
Wow, this is just so strange too. That this wave and of humanoids, and it sounds like the second humanoids are kind of more of what's on the cover of the book.
Yes, the smaller beings on the cover of the book are the humanoids, represent the humanoids.
Okay.
And then the larger being that's trailing behind them represents the robot in that artistic impression of them. And the interesting thing, Alejandro, is that there was communication going on between these beings and their craft. Mr. Shrum felt that they were using various forms of audible and visible communication during this encounter. He heard these audible noises, which could have been mistaken for owls, the hooting of owls or the cooing of birds, but it seemed that every time there was an audible signal that he heard that sounded like this, then the behavior of the creatures would change. They would start doing something else. Like in one instance, he heard these sounds, and then the humanoids started to attempt to climb the tree. So he felt that there was communication. There was also visual communication because he saw flashes of light passing between these creatures. And so apparently there was communication going on. The other thing is, while all of this is unfolding below him at the base of the tree, these creatures are approaching him. He became, of course, he realized that they knew that he was there. They knew his presence. And he was very, very concerned because as events unfolded, it became clear to him that they were trying to capture him, possibly to use him as a specimen for experimentation. He had a very bad feeling about what their intent was. And Reuben has spent a lot of time with the principal eyewitness, Mr. Shrum. And I wonder, Reuben, if you would tell us about how Mr. Shrum reacts even all these many years after this happened whenever he starts talking about his encounter with these beings.
Thank you, Noe. I had to disconnect the microphone to get past my coughing phase here. But
nope, you're a little low, Reuben.
Okay, how about now?
Still pretty quiet.
We can come back to Reuben while he gets that microphone working, if you want, Alejandro.
Okay.
I'll just say that when Reuben has spent time talking to Mr. Shrum and his family, Mr. Shrum still becomes highly disturbed and agitated. And I saw that in the video interviews that Reuben conducted with Mr. Shrum. He becomes very tense and starts to kind of shake. His eyes become watery as he recounts what it was like for him to be up in that tree, suddenly surrounded by these creatures. And so in this next clip, we're going to hear the incredible story of what happens when the attack against them actually begins. And it begins in a very subtle manner. The creature that he refers to as a robot stepped up to the base of the tree and then emitted a strange vapor that drifted up into the tree and caused Mr. Shrum to black out. And that's the next clip we're going to hear. That's clip number 350.
Then he come down up on the rock. He was about 7 feet from me. And then he touched his mouth and kind of a steam vapor come out of his mouth and it lit up his face so I could see some detail. And then I blacked out when that steam hit me, or I guess it was. It was kind of took the air from me, and I'd gasp for air and then black out, and I fell over my bow, and that's the only thing that kept me in the tree. And then, so I figured they were out to get me then.
So things started turning ugly.
We figure that the vapor that was sent up to him was some type of asphyxiant. And that's a category of gases that basically what they do is they suck up all the oxygen content from the surrounding air. Typical asphyxiants are nitrogen, argon, and helium. So even though they're not toxic, they won't damage human tissue. They could still possibly be lethal because if all the oxygen is removed from the air, a person will suffocate eventually. But in this case, there was only a small cloud of it causing Mr. Shrum to just black out momentarily. But the problem was that these creatures kept doing this over and over to him over the course of the many hours that night that he spent battling these creatures. So it happened over and over that they would, you know, the robot would move close below him, would emit another burst of vapor and causing him to black out for a few moments. He has told us that he wasn't out for very long because later on in the encounter, he noticed that after they blacked him out, the two humanoids would attempt to climb the tree. However, he would awaken before they had gotten very far up, and then he would take measures such as shaking the tree, such as making sure that they wouldn't reach him, that he would cause them to fall back. So the blackout times were not very long. But as I mentioned, they continued all throughout the night. Now, the only thing that he had to fight back with, he had very few weapons at his disposal or anything that could be used as a weapon. He did have his 60-pound recurve wooden bow with a 28-inch pull, and that's a pretty significant weapon, especially when it's fired at close range. An arrow coming out of a 60-pound bow has about the same velocity as a rifle shot. But the problem was he only had three arrows. So in this next clip, he's going to talk about how he decided to take the offensive after the gassing incident started. He decided to take the offensive and use the major weapon that he had at his disposal, which was a low-tech bow and three arrows. And we're going to hear that in this next clip.
So I had a 60-pound bow, which is a very high velocity. And I shot... Seeing as how the robot is the only thing that was causing me harm, I shot the chest area, and it has the velocity of a rifle at that distance, because I'm only about 7-8 feet from him. And it, when I hit the chest, the sparks would fly like electrical, like an arc welder kind of. And then that robot backed up and almost knocked him down. He kind of fell back against the rock. And the two at the bottom took off and headed for the brush and stood out there about 30 feet from me. And I shot two more arrows, and it was about the same time sequence that these two humanoids would, every time I'd shoot, they'd go back up into the brush, just almost out of sight from me.
How strange. You know, this whole incident is kind of reminding me of the little green man in Kentucky, incident in the 50s, it's just, you know, these things coming at him all night long because you would think that, as in other abduction cases, if they wanted him, they could have snatched him, they could have knocked him out, or done in other abduction cases, but these guys just are so weird, they're just kind of like playing with him all night.
It is a strange case in terms of the UFO cases of that time period, but another interesting thing is that We kind of feel as though there was another agenda here on the part of the ETs. They were there not expecting to run across any human beings, we think. Mr. Shrum noticed when they first appeared that they were looking around the brush. They were breaking off little pieces or little samples of the surrounding brush. They were engaged in some kind of research or study of the surrounding vegetation, possibly the surrounding mineral deposits. We don't know for sure what they were doing, but apparently it caught them rather by surprise, and they probably were not prepared to deal with the finding of a living human being there in the middle of their area where they had this mission that they were carrying out. And so, however, once it came to their attention that he was there, at least Mr. Shrum got the impression that they decided at some point to add him to their collection of specimens. Mm-hmm. And so, but they didn't seem to have any sort of weapons. He saw nothing in their possession that could have been construed as a weapon, other than, of course, this vapor that they released out of the mouth of the robot-type creature, and they kept releasing at him. Well, the interesting part of this story now, we're getting to really the climax of the battle. And what happens next is that, you know, he decided to target the robot creature, which was releasing the gas. He decided to target that with his arrows. But unfortunately, all three arrows bounced harmlessly off the robot's thick suit or whatever outer covering it had. Mr. Shrum felt that he could have done a lot more damage to the humanoids if he had targeted them. However, at this point in the encounter, the humanoids had not made any sort of aggressive move toward him. The only menacing part of the encounter at that point was the robots releasing the gas. So that's why he decided not to target the humanoids. And every time he would shoot at the robot, as he said in that last audio clip, the humanoids would move away back out into the brush. Well, what happened next is he decided that he would, since he was out of arrows, he would start throwing fire. He would light things on fire and throw it down at them. He would do everything in his power to try to keep them from their apparent attempts to abduct him. So in this next clip, we're going to hear about his efforts to throw fire, set things on fire, and throw it down at the ETs.
Then I ran out of arrows, so I only had three left. And that's when pomade hair, the cap I had on was just soaked with oil.
It was for your hair?
Yeah, from my hair, yeah, pomade. And I always carried all kinds of books of matches with me when I hunted. And so I lit that cap and it just blazed up and I dropped it down the base of the tree. And just in that instant, they moved back about 12, 15 feet. And I glanced over at the ship that was over the canyon, kind of almost level with me. And it was almost out of sight. It was just like a star. It moved that fast.
Wow.
Just in that second. So then I got the idea that they're scared of fire. So I burned everything but my T-shirt and my jeans, and come to find out later on that it was 32 degrees out, and I was shaking and kind of overexposed for the weather. And I had a bunch of change, and I threw it down, and they all kind of gathered around it. Well, after I shot my, or started burning stuff and throwing it down, And I even tied some of my shirt that I ripped up to a compass so I could try to hit some brush, because there wasn't nothing right underneath the tree. And in, I caught a little pile of brush on fire. I figured that would bring the cavalry. But when I run out of stuff to burn, I headed for the top of the tree. And then it was a pretty sparse tree. I could see down to the ground. And I broke off the top and threw it down. And anytime I throw down or shake the tree, these humanoids would back up.
Wow. What an adventure. I mean, this needs to get made into a movie. And I love this part here where it's kind of a sign of the times where, you know, his hair is greased up. And so yeah, that grease is in his cap. So he lights his cap on fire and drops it.
He was very resourceful. Can you hear me now?
A little bit. You're a little low, but...
Okay. The story goes on. There's still a lot more detail that, unfortunately, we're not able to present, but because of the time. But something very significant happened, and I was wondering, Noe, if you would mind talking about the other robot creature that showed up.
Oh, yes. The two robots... At first, there was only the one that came and was releasing the vapor. But then another robot creature showed up toward the tail end of this encounter. And the two robots faced each other under the base of the tree. And this strange bolt of like lightning streaked across from one robot to the other and then would bounce back and forth. And there was this, he described it like, watching a welder's arc. It was very intensely bright. It was flashing between the chests of these two robot creatures. And then an immense cloud of vapor, much larger than the small puffs that had come up to the tree before, this immense cloud of vapor came up toward him from this this activity that was going on between the two robots. And that finally caused him to black out for a much longer period of time than before. And in fact, when he woke up from that one, everything was over and the creatures and the craft were gone. So we're going to hear the witness say this in clip number 550, which is the final gassing.
After I went to the top of the tree, I had a military belt, and I moved it out to the last hitch and put it around me and the tree. So in case I did get gassed, I wouldn't fall down. And then, like I said, I threw chains down and everything to try to distract them. And then finally, these two humanoids stepped back from the tree, and another robot came, and there was two just about the same place that the two humanoids were, and they stood facing each other, and the flames just like lightning, and it real, real bright, and just came between them. And the gas was so thick coming up the tree that it would dissipate just about the time I got to me. But then that's when I'd start the gas for air. And then when I woke up from that, it was light, but the sun hadn't come up yet. And I was just hanging by my belt, my head down, my feet down, and they were gone. Well, I knew I made it. I lived through the night.
Just go back. Did you fall asleep, or this gas? Did it overwhelm you?
Yeah, that's when it just it completely engulfed the whole tree and got up to me. And at, I don't know how long I was out, but it was just you could see just a dim glow of the sun in the on the clouds and stuff, not clouds, but in the sky. And then when I woke up, it was light, but the sun hadn't come up yet.
Wow. So, yeah, we've got about 5 minutes or so to talk about what happened in the aftermath, but finally it's over. So then was he able to climb down and reunite with his friends?
Yeah, we actually have enough of this story left to do a whole another hour, so we'll have
I'm
to
sure.
be back. We'll have to come back later. But basically, he did come down from the tree. His buddies saw that he was in a very distraught condition. He was extremely tired. In fact, he slept for 6 hours before they could get anything further out of him.
Wow.
And also, he found out that one of his buddies, Vincent Alvarez, who later gave a written affidavit, had seen the initial entry of the mothership from out of the Earth's atmosphere coming down through the sky, and he saw it. He saw the object, and he testified to that later on to further bolster what Mr. Shrum had witnessed. And so when he got home, his wife saw what a horrible state Mr. Shrum was. Today, you know, what he experienced for months and years afterward, today would be called post-traumatic stress syndrome. But in the early 60s, of course, that phrase hadn't been coined yet. But really, he had a horrible time of it for a long time. And then the worst part of it was when the Air Force became involved, some investigators were sent to him from Wright-Patterson Air Base in Dayton, Ohio, and they tried to convince him that what he saw out in that forest had a conventional explanation. They proposed several scenarios, including that it was a troop of Boy Scouts that was out playing pranks on people. That was one possible explanation. Hmm. And the other one was that it could have been some Japanese soldiers left over from World War II. And mind you, this was 1964, so that was a long time after World
War II. Right.
That were still wandering around the Tahoe National Forest, causing trouble for any Americans they ran
into. Oh, my gosh. Using superpowers of some sort.
So, I mean, the story becomes really bizarre. And the other interesting thing, just to summarize quickly, is that Mr. Shrum was deeply affected by what happened, of course. And there seemed to be a psychological connection with these beings that he experienced later in life. There was an episode where he and his family were sitting at a campfire out camping one evening when all of a sudden he heard this intense screeching in his ears that only he could hear. And everybody sitting around the campfire, his family and his friends, saw him turn and look at a ridge off in the distance. And then a few moments afterward, a UFO came zooming over the ridge and right above their heads. All of them saw it. And later on, they talked to him and told him, how did you know to turn? And he said, I knew they were coming, and I was afraid they were coming for me.
Wow, that's pretty incredible.
Yeah, the profound statement that he made at the very end of his interview, I asked him, well, how did you feel, or what do you think it was this whole outcome? And he said, it's as I won. It's as they didn't take me. And that struck me.
You're right. Well, has he ever done any sort of regression to find out what happened while he was blacked out?
Yes, we didn't have a chance to speak a lot about this, but after, you know, during that final blackout period, which was several hours in length before he came to, and it was, well, it was a longer period of time than his other blackouts. We don't know the exact amount of time, but he was very concerned that during that final blackout period that they had actually reached him, that they had climbed up and reached him and possibly done things to him. He was very, very concerned, and that was part of the great stress and trauma that he experienced for years afterward. But it turned out that when they did, Paul Cerny arranged for a a doctor to come and do a session of regressive hypnotherapy with him. They went back. They took him back. They put his fears aside by telling him that he was an observer only, looking down at the scene. He was not actually a participant in it. And once he calmed down and he could analyze everything, then he was made to realize, or it became clear to him, that they never reached him. There were no further attempts to reach him after that. They apparently finished whatever mission they were on, and then they left, and he was left unmolested, hanging there at the top of this pine tree.
Wow, this is a fascinating story, and thank you guys so much for also providing these audio clips, because it adds so much to be able to hear from the witness himself, you know, hearing his inflections and recalling everything, and it seems like he's here with us. So, you know, you talked about how there's a lot more to the story, but that's a good plug for the book, because people can go to roswellbooks.com and order the book and read what else there was with the story.
That's correct. Or you can just do a search for it on Amazon or BarnesandNoble.com, and it's Aliens in the Forest. There's a lot of more detail in the book, and we've got a lot of the documents that Paul Cerny collected about the case, a lot of the early detailed reports and so forth, and probably close to 100 illustrations, maps, and other graphics. So it's a very enjoyable. We've gotten really positive comments from our reviewers so far.
Great. So what's up next for you guys? Working on new projects?
We're going to revisit the Robert Willingham UFO encounter near Del Rio, Texas in 1955. We wrote a book called The Other Roswell a few years back, and some interesting new information has come forward in this case. The witness has shared with us information that he did not feel comfortable sharing with us when we did the first edition of the book. So we're going to be issuing a new edition, which contains a lot more information from the eyewitness, Colonel Robert Willingham.
All right, great. Ruben, did you want to add?
Can you hear me now?
A little bit.
I'm so sorry that I wasn't able to participate.
No problem.
Just coughing my head off here in the background. But, as Noe has mentioned, we're going back to some of our books and updating them, because there's always new information that comes along, even some additional information from our first book, Mexico's Roswell. There's some interesting information that has also come to us. So we really hope that the audience had enjoyed this interview and get a copy of our book, and we're always open to any feedback.
All right. I'm sure they did. I think this was fascinating. It's just I'm kind of overwhelmed myself, and I can't wait to review the story. I think it's so incredible. It's a fascinating, it's an incredible story. So it's just mind-blowing. So it's great. Thank you guys so much. It's always great to have you on. You guys are there's a lot of friends out there in the field, and you guys are certainly some of my best buddies out there. So it's great to hear from you guys. Thank you so much for making time to come on the show and talk about this incredible story.
Thank you very much, Alejandro, and have a great 2012, man. It's a whole new year for us.
You too. I think it's going to be a good one. I'm excited.
2012 is going to rock.
So, speaking of rocking, those guys rock. Ruben and Noe, I love those guys. Remember, roswellbooks.com is where you can get their books and see the latest and all of their books. They got quite a few, including that Cowboys and Aliens one we talked about at the beginning. So exciting stuff, roswellbooks.com. That's pretty easy to remember. Also, don't forget, if you are an aspiring filmmaker and you've made a film or are finishing up a UFO documentary of some sort, remember the EBE Awards at the UFO Congress. You still have time to submit your movie. So to go to the UFOCongress.com and submit your movie to win at the illustrious EBE Award. Everybody, the coveted little alien, you know, plaque that everyone's always excited to win. So go do that. Also, don't forget to check out UFODailyNews.com. I have some cool pictures were my UFOs and aliens and them being a hot topic for celebrities in 2011. Celebs were talking a lot about UFOs last year, so check out that story and some cool videos and pictures. And then always don't forget to visit openminds.tv for the latest news and UFO stories from cool people like Jason McClellan. All right, we'll talk to you next week, people.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm gonna make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you wanna get mixed up in the family business?
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
VGW Group, no purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions 18+.